Welcome back to Conversations with Great Minds. Tonight, I am speaking with historian and political economist Gar Alperovitz. We've been talking about how change happens and how the system has been put together in America and kind of these cycles of history also that we're seeing in the United States. And you were talking about worker-owned cooperatives, some of the examples in Chicago. I think most people think, when you say worker-owned co-op, most people think my local health food store.
Right.
You know, or sometimes it's a garage, and there are a lot of those around the country. But these are fairly small-scale things. How do you scale this up to reach the kind of mass necessary to create a stable flywheel part of a very complex and constantly moving economy?
Well, it's obviously, first, it's a development process over decades, but there's a really interesting experiment going on in Cleveland. We were talking about that before. And these are not your corner grocery store little co-ops. For instance, there's an industrial-scale laundry there. It's about the greenest ecologically in the entire part of the Midwest there. It's in a LEED Gold-certified structure. Mm-hmm. And it's a large-scale system. They also is a solar installation company. These are all worker-owned. Solar installation company that is online to produce more solar installations than the entire state of Ohio already has.
Wow.
And there is another company, and they're putting about two online every year, I think is the pattern. Another company there is a greenhouse, solar heated greenhouse, in part solar heated. But again, not your corner grocery store. We're talking about 3 million heads of lettuce a year, that scale.
Wow.
So the idea is there's no reason these can't be scaled up. Worker ownership and worker participation, the studies show hands down, productivity goes up, retention stays up, training costs go down because people are retained, just what you might expect if people have an ownership stake. And so I think we're going to see scaling, something like some of the things that we talked about in Spain, where they've gone really much larger, on these same principles, and I suspect that's one of the directions, again, over the next decades, and particularly as other things are failing. That's really the context. The context is critical here. If everything was working fine, you wouldn't be seeing people developing new things. But things aren't working fine, so we're seeing very, just under the surface, all over the country, this kind of thing is beginning to pop up.
Well, and in Spain, several generations ago, this young priest showed up in Mondragon, in this town that was kind of falling apart in the Basque region of Spain, and said, let's put something together. And they've developed this amazing thing. We've both been there. You've spent a lot more time there and done a lot more research on it. I'm curious if you'd share with our viewers in particular, what is the Mondragon Cooperative, or Mondragon?
Mondragon, yes.
And why is it of consequence to us here in the United States? What can we learn from it? And what are the upsides and the downsides to it?
Well, Mondragon is fascinating, and it's becoming the model of interest around the world. And basically, it was started something like 55 years ago by a priest in that area. There were no jobs. And again, that's like Cleveland or Detroit, no jobs. And the question was, how do we build? And he started in a complex way. He started with a school, actually, an engineering school, trying to train people. They are now 85,000 people working in almost 80 different co-ops. But they're linked together with a financing system. They're linked together with training programs. And it is real worker participation that people make the decisions up and down the line. You'll find the shop clerk on the board of directors, and you'll find people making a real participatory strategy. And it's highly productive and very, very effective. And we're not talking about agricultural, just they have supermarkets, they have medical equipment, advanced research, they do high tech, they do construction, just like any major. It's a multinational corporation of that scale.
And a multi-billion dollar corporation.
Multi-billion dollar. So it's a model that tells you and what can be done. And it gives you really new ideas because it's neither, and I think the essence of this book, America Beyond Capitalism, you don't have to have it either capitalism or socialism, the state socialism, the corporate capitalism. And it doesn't have to be half of this hybrid. There are new things to do, and Mondragon is one of them. Mondragon has run into some problems, so it's not the full answer because it's now run into the world market. It's so big. And the Chinese and the East Europeans are beginning to undercut them, some of their markets. So they're looking for markets. They're actually over here now trying to help set up companies with the Steel Workers Union and others around the country.
Yeah, Leo Gerard has been. He's all over Montreal. Loves the topic.
Yeah, it's happening here. They're coming here, but they're coming here really looking for markets for jobs and so forth.
Sure.
And if you go back to what I was saying about Buenos Aires or these hospitals, I think it's a more interesting model. The work in Cleveland has Mondragon, has been based in part on Mondragon, but trying to use these institutions that are partly publicly funded, hospitals have got a lot of medical money in it, universities, to stabilize the market by purchasing some part of what they produce, then you're not always up against the competition. You get more stability at the local level. So those kind of mixes of almost a planning system to help stabilize, but also be in competition so you don't get too much ahead of yourself without competition. Right. Those really interesting developments of this kind are happening.
I was in Madison a few months ago and talked to the people who run the Union Cab Company, and there's a manufacturing company there. Peninsula, no, Isthmus.
Yes.
Manufacturing, where tool and dies and actually all kinds of fancy stuff. Worker-owned cooperatives. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I discovered was that many states, most states in the United States, don't have a corporate charter provision in their state laws that would allow these kind of companies to even come into existence and you know, be recognized by the state as a legal entity and be appropriately taxed and regulated and all the things that are necessary for a company to exist. You write about B corporations, and we only have four states in the country.
So far.
So what is a B corporation? Why only four states? And how many states even allow things like just basic, genuine worker-owned and run cooperatives?
I don't have the answer to the last question, but I do know that people have found wrinkles in the law where you can change the corporate charter and do it as a business or as an ESOP and find democratic participation, democratic control. And there are ways to develop within the law, legal structure, and in some states change the co-op laws. But so a B Corp is an example. We have it here in just off, over here in Maryland. Senator Jamie Raskin was behind doing that, very bright young senator. It's a very simple idea. If you are a corporate chief or you're on the board, your legal responsibility is to make profits for the shareholders. And if you deviate too far from that and try to do good things for the community spending too much corporate money, you are legally subject to challenge by the stockholders.
You're talking about Dodge v. Ford back in the 30s in Michigan Supreme Court.
That's the issue. So a B Corp, it's a different form of incorporation that is set up so that you are allowed to actually do things for the community. And then if someone invests in that kind of a B Corp, they know what they're getting into and they support you for that reason. And it takes the law, it just changes that wrinkle in the law and opens up ways for environmental or community contributions. It's very interesting.
You know, up until the mid-1890s, I think it was, whenever Ohio kicked out John Rockefeller and the charter-mongering era, it was about a 6 or 7 year period there where all the states were changing their corporate charter laws and this massive competition on the East Coast that Delaware ended up winning, although New Jersey ended up with John Rockefeller. Prior to that time, pretty much every state in the United States required that the first sentence of Articles of Incorporation be, this corporation is established to enhance or support or serve the community of fill in the blank, and to manufacture railroad cars. And that requirement that their first obligation be to serve the community was stripped out in virtually every state during that one decade window, and then over the next 30 or 40 years, every other state took it out. Couldn't we just put that back?
Well, we could.
Wouldn't there be one way to do it and then say C-corps, you don't have a problem anymore?
Right, that is a possibility. What's happened, of course, has gone in the other direction to personhood and really time to challenge that whole idea. Corporations initially, way back in the first part of the country and also in Britain, were chartered by the government to do a public purpose.
That's right. The Erie Canal Corporation was one of them.
Exactly, and all of the big corporations. Yeah. There was no such thing, really, for all purposes, as a corporation just to make money. Right. It was an institution set up by the state and chartered to do economic activity for the good of the society, and you could make some money doing that, but it was very narrowly defined. Yeah. And we've gone a long way from that now, so that now they're people for all intents and purposes.
Yeah. And the railroads and Reconstruction, that was kind of the pivot point for all of that after the Civil War. So the Occupy Wall Street movement, it seems to me that there are some incredible parallels. I just discovered that there's a book about the Hoovervilles. We had all these Hoovervilles in the late 20s, early 30s, and the biggest one was in Seattle. The mayor of the mayor of that Hooverville in that city was a fellow by the name of Jesse Jackson, and he wrote a book about, you know, the experience, which we're, I'm trying to track down right now. Got pieces of it. And their philosophy and their behavior seemed really similar to the Occupy movement. Right. I mean, they were occupying territory all over the country. Right. And local governments would come in and knock them down, burn them out, kick them out. They'd come right back.
Right.
Do you see history repeating itself? Do you see the Occupy movement as something that might propel this forward, or is that just an interesting analogous parallel?
Well, I think what's interesting about the Occupy movement is that they have occupied as a way of raising consciousness, spectacular raising of consciousness. They've really cracked open a whole debate with just some kids sitting down.
Yeah.
But I think they're interested in new ideas, and where do we take it beyond that into politics, beyond the Hoovervilles,
yeah.
Getting out in the communities, doing politics, building new institutions. I think that direction is part and parcel of where that's going to go, and hopefully it'll begin to take. We've had a great deal of interest in all of these models because it gives people something to hold on to and build forward with.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're going to be very political as well as institution building.
If I'm curious, in the 2 minutes we have left here, mm-hmm. your thoughts on how politicians, how are your ideas being received here on Capitol Hill or in the various states, whether it's the idea of state banks, you know, more of a micro level or at the macro level, you know, just changing the fundamentals of capitalism.
Well, it's very interesting because it isn't bipartisan, but for instance, in the state of Indiana, the very conservative Republican treasurer is putting state money down in a way as deposits to lower interest rates for worker-owned companies. And over on the other side, Sherrod Brown has been toying with legislation to help develop worker co-ops.
Right.
So there's kind of an interesting thing. I don't think it hasn't shaken out yet. And of course, when we get to the larger level, when some of these banks, the Wall Street banks, are, I'm sure there's going to be a big fight. When the next big crisis comes, there's going to be demands to take them over, and that's
yeah.
going to be a big fight politically. But at the local level, in some areas, there's a lot of kind of coherence. You don't find the same kind of ideology in most local areas, particularly when there's a great deal of economic pain.
Right.
And people are looking for answers, and that's what's very interesting about this period.
Is there any conversation about this on Capitol Hill?
There is some conversation. The co-op bill was introduced this week to
really?
Foster co-ops. This is the year of the co-ops, the United Nations. There's this work that I think the ESOP form,
yeah.
Rohrabacher, one of the yeah. most conservative members of Congress, is calling for ESOPs that are one person, one vote. So there's a very interesting, just under the surface, left-right kind of experimentation in this area that probably, again, as the pain deepens, people, I think, are going to be doing much more of this.
That's remarkable and important stuff. Professor Alperovitz, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Honor to have you and
my pleasure.
To hear your thoughts. To watch this conversation again, as well as other conversations with great minds, check out our website at conversationswithgreatminds.com.